following Simon & Schuster Audio Works presentation is a recording of a lecture by M. Scott Peck. Doctor, psychotherapist, lecturer, and author, Dr. Peck has spoken frequently in major cities throughout the United States. His books include the bestseller The Road Less Traveled, People of the Lie, What Return Can I Make, and The Different Drum. Here now is Dr. Peck.
The title of my talk is Self-Love versus Self-Esteem. And basically, this talk arises out of the fact that we do not have accurate words for the phenomenon that I'm going to talk about. And these two things are confused a great deal in ways I think that cause us a lot of trouble. And eventually, I hope that the problem will be somewhat solved by us developing new words. We're stuck with old ones. Now, to give you a distinction between self-love, which I'm going to say is a good thing, and self-esteem, which I am going to say is a questionable thing, and where the title of this talk comes from, back when I was in the military became interested in what sort of made successful people click. And so they gathered together a dozen such people from different branches of the service in the Department of Defense, men and women in their late 30s, early 40s, who'd all been markedly successful. They had been promoted ahead of their contemporaries, yet they also seemed to be popular. Those who had families, their family life seemed to be going well, their children seemed to be doing beautifully. They seemed to have a golden touch. Everything that they touched seemed to turn out well. And we studied these dozen people in various dimensions, sometimes as a group, sometimes individually. One of the things that we did individually at this retreat center where we were studying them was that we asked them if they would write down, working by themselves, on a piece of paper, the three most important things in their life in order. So number one would be the most important, number two would be the second most important, number three would be the third most important. And there were two things that were quite remarkable about the way this group of people handled this task. One was the seriousness with which they took it. So the first person didn't return for about 40 minutes. And a number of the people took well over an hour, even though they knew that most of the others had returned. So they took it very seriously. And the other thing that was remarkable was that while their answers for number two and three ranged all over the map, all 12 had exactly the same answer for number one. Exactly. Do you know what that was? Yes. All 12 had written myself. Same word. It's the most important thing in their lives. Now, about 8-9 years after that, I had the occasion to get close enough to a person of the lie, and they are hard people to get close to, but I got close enough to him to ask him at one point. I said, what is the single most important thing in your life? While these people are usually not very honest, he didn't know that he was being revealing at all. And what do you think his answer was? My self-esteem. Notice how close it is. The 12 successful people had written myself, and he wrote my self-esteem. And in fact, this is correct in terms of the way that those people that I've dared to call the people of the lie function, or people that might even be called evil. And that is that their self-esteem is the single most important thing in their life, and they will do anything in order to preserve and maintain their self-esteem at all times, and at all costs. And if there is anything that threatens their self-esteem, if there is any evidence around them of their own sin or imperfection or something which might cause them to feel badly about themselves, well then, rather than using that evidence to feel badly about themselves and make some kind of correction, instead they will go about trying to exterminate the evidence, which is where much of their evil behavior arises from. because it is necessary for them to preserve their self-esteem at all costs. So one of the major messages that I'm going to be talking about today is how, in order to be healthy people, pay the price of setting aside our self-esteem and not always feeling good about ourselves. And there's a difference between regarding ourselves as important and a difference between that and insisting that we always feel good about ourselves. Now, I'd like to talk for just a minute about humility. In the road less traveled, you may remember that I borrowed a definition of humility from The Cloud of Unknowing, a mystical book written by an anonymous 13th century British monk. He used the word meekness, but he could equally well have used the word humility, and so I'll substitute humility. And he said, meekness or humility is a true knowledge of oneself as one is. Anyone who truly knows oneself will be meek indeed. So it is a humility is a true, accurate knowledge of oneself. And there are certain things that this means. For instance, if I were to say to you that I am a lousy writer, that actually would not be a humble statement. Because the truth of the matter is that people go, I am a relatively good writer. So that would not be humble, actually. That would be pseudo-humility. On the other hand, if I were to tell you that I was a good golfer, that would be highly inaccurate. It would not be a true knowledge of myself as I am, be highly arrogant. So it's important for us to have a true knowledge of ourselves as we are and to be able to recognize both the good parts of ourselves and also to be able to recognize the bad parts of ourselves, to be realistic, to have a true knowledge of ourselves. What I'm going to do now is focus on these two sides and first bring you the bad news and talk about thinking about the bad parts of ourselves and ways in which we should not feel self-esteem. And then I'm going to conclude on the positive aspect of things and talk about the other side of the coin, which is how important that we should love ourselves and value ourselves, not necessarily esteem ourselves. How many of you were at the lecture last night? Most all of you. Good. Well, you remember I quoted there the Saint Therese of Lisieux as saying in a letter to her sister, if you are willing to serenely bear the trial of being displeasing to yourself, then you will be for Jesus a pleasant place of shelter. Now, in talking about that trial of being displeasing to yourself, St. Therese was talking about a lack of self-esteem. If you are willing to go through periods where you do not have self-esteem, she was talking about guilt, where you feel guilty or where you feel contrite about what you have done, then you will be for Jesus a pleasant place of shelter. Now, she was a smart cookie, even though she died young, as I said, and she chose her words carefully, and as you may know, there are certain people that we call depressives, often it's a chronic kind of personality pattern, and they are real experts at feeling displeased with themselves, and they'll say, well, Dr. Peck, I'm just a total nerd. I'm not worth doing. I know that back in the service, I was a 3-star admiral, but that was just, I don't know how you can sit and listen to me week after week. I mean, I'm a miserable husband. I'm a miserable specimen of humanity. I'm dull. I'm boring. I really don't know how you can even care for me, how you can just keep sitting and taking care of me. And after a while, I say, yes, I am having serious difficulty. And as I said, St. Therese was a smart cookie, and she chose her words very carefully. And she said, if you're willing to serenely bear the trial of being displeasing to yourself, and the problem with such depressives is that they are not particularly serene about the business. And indeed, if you scratch through their pseudo-humility, their constant self-put-down, in short order, you usually run into a core of arrogance and narcissism, which that pseudo-humility disguises and which is often at the basis of their depression. In fact, such excessive breastfeeding is referred to in the church as the sin. It's called a sin, the sin of excessive scrupulosity, and is properly regarded by the church as a perverted form of the sin of pride. Essentially, what these people are saying, well, I know that God may forgive me, but I'll be the judge. I'm the judge of whether I should be forgiven or not. And one of the reasons that I very gradually gravitated toward Christianity is that I think that came to believe that Christianity, on the whole, wacky though it often seems, approaches reality a little more closely than the other religions do on the whole. And let me say just a little bit about this. One of the two greatest sins of our sinful Christian church, I think, is its kind of arrogance that it has, where it regards as other people as not being saved and sort of acts as if it's got a market on the truth. And this is not the way it works. Reality like God is only something that we can approach. Reality like God is not something that we can tie up in a nice, neat, intellectual little package and put in our briefcase and possess. God is bigger than us, and God is not ours to possess. We are his or hers to be possessed by. And so I have great difficulty with those Christians who kind of think that they've got God in their back pocket. Because the reality is that we cannot, God is bigger than our theology can only approach God. On the whole, I think Christian theology approaches it a little more closely than the other religions, although there are ways in which the other religions approach it more closely, that reality more closely than does Christianity. But anyway, one of the reasons I slowly gravitated toward Christianity is that I believe that Christian doctrine has the most correct understanding of the nature of sin. Again, it is a paradoxical, multidimensional understanding. It's so important to think in multidimensional terms. The first side of the paradox is that the Christianity holds that we are all sinners. We cannot not sin. There are a number of possible definitions of sin, but the most common, as many of you know, is simply missing the mark, failing to hit the bullseye every time. And there's no way that we can hit the bullseye every time. Sometimes we're going to be just a little careless, no matter how good we are. Sometimes we're going to be a little tired, not exert or extend ourselves quite enough. We cannot hit the bullseye every time. We cannot be perfect. And so Christianity holds that we are all sinners. We cannot not sin. And one true prerequisite for membership in the true Christian church is that you be a sinner. It is a group of all sinners, and if you do not think that you're a sinner, why then you are not a candidate for the church, the true church, anyway. Now, the other prong, the other side, however, is that the church and Christianity holds that if you confess or acknowledge a sin with contrition, then it is wiped out. It is as if it never existed. It is as if the slate has become clean and you can start over again, fresh and clean every time. That we cannot not sin. On the other hand, we are invariably forgiven of our sins, and the slate is wiped clean as long as we can confess or acknowledge them with contrition. There's a very sweet story I like about this subject. It's about a little Filipino girl who talked to Jesus, and people in her village began to become kind of excited about that, and then word got around a little more to some of the neighboring villages, and other people began to get excited about it, and finally word reached the bishop's palace in Manila, and the bishop became somewhat concerned, because after all, you can't have any unauthorized saints walking around in the Catholic Church, and so he appointed a Monsignor to investigate this case, and so this girl was brought to the bishop's palace for a series of psychiatric, psychotheological interviews. And at the end of the third interview, the Monsignor just threw up his hands and he said, well, he said, I just don't know, I don't know what to make of you. He said, I don't know whether you're for real or not. He said, but there is one acid test. And that is, the next time that you talk to Jesus, I would like you to ask Jesus what I confessed to at my last confession. Would you do that? And the little girl said that she would, and she went away and came back for her interview the next week, and with barely disguised eagerness, the Monsignor said, well, my dear, did you talk to Jesus this past week? And she said, yes, Your Holiness, I did. And he said, well, he said, when you talked to Jesus this past week, did you remember to ask Jesus what I confessed to at my last confession? She said, yes, Your Holiness, I did. He said, well, he said, when you asked Jesus what I confessed to at my last confession, what did Jesus say? And the little girl answered, Jesus said, I've forgotten. Now, there are two possible interpretations to that story. One is that that little girl was one smart little psychopathic cookie. But the other is that she was one really smart theologian, and so smart that in fact she probably really did talk to Jesus, because that is the kind of thing that Jesus would have said, that once our sins are confessed with contrition, then they are forgotten. It's as if they no longer exist. And if people, as I say, hold on to them after that, they're guilty of the sin of excessive scrupulosity. Now, that word contrition, again, that is what is meant by being displeased with yourself, of lacking self-esteem, feeling bad, suffering some over what you have done. And that is important, because it's not just necessary that sins be confessed or acknowledged, but also that they be acknowledged with contrition. In those churches that still have this confession of Catholic and Episcopal Church anyway, the priest must grant the penitent, the confessing person, absolution. He, or hopefully she, does not have the authority to withhold absolution from the person confessing, because since God forgives sins, the priest, as an agent of God, obviously has to forgive the person, except under one very rare circumstance. And that is that the priest can withhold absolution if he or she has very clear and present evidence that the person confessing the sin experiences no contrition. Now, you may ask, how can somebody confess a sin and not feel any contrition over it? To give you an example of that, back when I was 19, a long, long time ago, I had a heavy girlfriend at Wheaton College. This is not the religious Wheaton College out in Illinois, but it was then a women's college, maybe still is for all I know, in, down here in Massachusetts. Well, what you did back then, if you had a really heavy girlfriend at Wheaton College, was on Saturday nights, was that you checked into the Taunton, Massachusetts Inn, which even though this was the mid-50s, still at that point had a very liberal, no questions asked kind of policy about these sorts of things. And on this particular evening, my girlfriend and I had been palling around with a couple of other young couples, and during the evening I had taken a kind of nameless dislike to one of the other young men. I couldn't put my finger on it, but there's something about him that I just didn't feel right about. I didn't trust. Well, anyway, as we three couples at about 11 o'clock that evening were checking into the Taunton, Massachusetts Inn, separate rooms, three separate rooms. This young man, who I didn't feel quite right about, left a wake-up call for 5:30 in the morning. And as we were moving toward the elevator, I said, "My God," I said, "what are you doing leaving a wake-up call for 5:30 in the morning? What do you want to ruin this beautiful night for?" And he said, "Well," I said, "I got to get up and go to Mass." Well, I didn't know much about religion or Catholicism or anything at that point, but I got really kind of interested in this phenomenon. I said, "You can't go to Mass." I've heard sometimes that people go to confession before they go to Mass. And he said, "Yeah." "So tomorrow morning when you go to Mass, are you going to go to confession first?" And he said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, when you go to confession tomorrow morning, are you going to confess what you're going to do tonight?" And he said, "Oh, sure." Well, I'm not sure if I had been his priest and I knew what I knew that I necessarily would have granted him absolution because he didn't seem to have much contrition about what he was doing. I mean, it wasn't saying, "God, I know I shouldn't be doing this, but I'm so horny, but I it didn't seem to bother him at all. So as I said, I'm not sure. You know, for me, it was no problem, you see, because I didn't think what I was doing was a sin. So it's important, the essence of confession in many ways is contrition, this feeling bad about yourself, this lack of self-esteem. So we need, as I said, there is this thing called existential guilt last night. We need a certain amount of guilt. A certain amount of contrition in order to exist well. That if we, in fact, if we do not have this, then we have no self-corrective kind of mechanism. If we go around thinking that we're okay all the time, of course, correct those parts of us that are not okay. To give you a necessary for us to feel not so okay. I told you last night that I would talk some about the pain of the breaking of our pride. That book that you've, most of you heard about, "I'm Okay, You're Okay," it is a very good book, but I really don't like the title very much because what happens if you're not okay? I'm not sure it's all right to think that you're okay if you're not okay. What happens if you wake up every morning at 2 o'clock in the morning drenched in sweat, dreaming of drowning, and then you're so filled with dread that you can't get back to sleep until 6 o'clock in the morning, and that goes on not only night after night, but week after week, month after month? Is it all right to think that you're okay then? Or what happens if you can't go into a store without having a panic attack and that you've got to flee out? Is it all right to think that you're okay then? What happens if you're driving your children to drugs? Serious trouble, is it all right to think that you're okay? Or what happens if you're driving your children to drugs and serious trouble and you're not even conscious that you're driving them into drugs? Is it all right to think that you're okay? I think, again, that AA has a much better way of putting it. There's a saying in AA that "I'm not okay and you're not okay, but that's okay." And indeed, back when I was still in the practice of psychotherapy, I used to have a certain investment financially in people thinking that they were not okay. Because people do not come to psychotherapy who think that they are okay. They only come when they think that they are not okay. And that's one of the reasons that people that come to psychotherapy are such wonderful people. They start off with humility.